In the fall each year we all congregate, the bad dog gathered at the church's tailgate. The scriptures reading from the book of Munson, our favorite verse, my God, a freshman. Drunk and obnoxious, what Georgia fame, ain't nothing finer in the land. Now the 3,000 of our best friends, it's Saturday in that thing.
Welcome to the Saturday in Athens podcast. We are a Georgia Bulldogs show by dogs fans for dogs fans. I am your host, Herschel Gurley, and we are thrilled to be joined today by DGD Rennie Kern. Rennie played for the Dogs from 2007 to 2009, finished up his business degree after his professional career in the NFL ended. He was a third-round pick in the 2002 NFL draft. He's now an entrepreneur, author, and speaker. Rennie, thank you for joining us today. We are fired up to have you.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be on.
So I want to start with you in Snellville, where you grew up and played high school ball. And I just want you to start by telling us about the role music and sports played in your upbringing.
Yeah, that's an awesome first question, man. I actually grew up the first part of my life in Atlanta, Atlanta. So we're off of Notre Hills, Beaufort Highway area, kind of in that Brookhaven area, but on the other side where, you know, there's more Hispanics and, you know, African-Americans and whatnot. And so I was a knucklehead as a child, man. I was the only boy, youngest of three. Both my parents, most people know, are immigrants from Liberia who came here. My mom came on scholarship to Emory and got her master's in nursing. So that's how we ended up here in Atlanta. And she eventually went on to work at Grady. So when I say I'm Atlanta, as Atlanta as it gets. So I was actually born in Crawford Long. It's now Emory Midtown. And then I went to daycare. There was a daycare in front of Grady. So that's how Atlanta I am. But so music, man, came in when, as a child, man, like I said, I was a knucklehead. I was already in the streets at 8 years old, just trying to find something to do and trying to find my identity. And one of the things my mom did to get me to calm down was she got me into music. So I had me start taking piano lessons at 8 years old, and had a older piano teacher and played in the church and all those different things. And from there, I went on to play the drums in church. And by the time I was in middle school and by the time we had moved to Gwinnett, I was also in the orchestra playing the viola. So music was a huge role in my life, man. It kind of gave me an alternate identity. And there's so many things. I talked to somebody else about it before, but I don't believe that there's enough research out there to really explain the translation between music and being a musician and working that side of your brain and how it relates to sports and how it can help set you apart. But I truly believe that it does. I mean, it's no different than that athlete who plays multiple sports and who excels in multiple sports. You know, it just gives you a different perspective. Or you could even look at, you know, in the game of football, you have certain guys who play positions that, you know, they may have played defensive back, now they play quarterback, right? And so having that difference in perspective just helps them to be able to perform a whole lot better. So I think that was the same with me in music, man. That was something that I did all throughout, even at University of Georgia. I always had a musical instrument. Piano, or, you know, my viola. I still have a musical setup now, so it really, really does make a difference. And playing linebacker, I mean, it's a very cerebral position. So I was able to use a lot of what I learned through music. And even if you play in an orchestra, it's a team. You know, you have to be mindful of everybody around you, the timing, everything like that. So I truly believe that helped me as a linebacker.
It's interesting you bring that up, because I was thinking about this as I was preparing, and it seems there are some parallels between the discipline that it takes to hone your craft musically. And, you know, I think there's a lot of equity there with honing your craft athletically, because a lot of that work is done when nobody's watching. Right. Oh, and yeah. I think there's just a lot of parallels between those two paths. And that's a really interesting point about kind of using both sides of the brain and developing that, and how that can translate to athletic success. I hadn't really thought about that side of it, but I agree. That would be an interesting thing to see researched and fleshed out to see if there are some parallels to that. Because to your point, and I can't name any off the top of my head, but I know just from the sports we consume, there are tons of athletes just via, like, whether it's a Tom Rinaldi story or whoever, right, where they talk about the music they play or the instruments that they played. And it would be interesting to see kind of how many guys who have reached the pinnacle of their athletic careers also had some musical background as well. So that's cool. So when did football become, I guess, the main athletic focus? Did you play that solely most of your life, or were you playing multiple sports? When did that become the area that you honed in on?
Man, football was always kind of that sport that I knew was kind of it. I was always naturally a rough kid, and I don't know what it was, man, but I tried basketball. I grew up around the time when Space Jam came out, so I thought I wanted to be like Mike, just like every other kid. But I quickly realized, like, I was horrible at anything that involved, like, a sense of touch. So whether it's basketball, bowling, golf, I'm horrible at any sport that involves anything other than going full speed and, like, just running through something. So that was just my nature, man. And so when I found football, man, organized football at 10 years old, playing in Gwinnett in the Brookwood High School system, man, it just was one of those things where I didn't necessarily know what I was doing right away, but I knew I had the ability, knew I had instincts, like, that was just different. And I realized that from the first time I touched the football, man, as a young kid, before I even moved to Gwinnett, playing backyard football, it just was like I had spidey senses that just clicked on. as I progressed, man, as I learned more and more about the game, I just started to really, really be able to leverage those skill sets, man. So I was able to be fortunate enough to have a great little league coach. His name was Ronnie Benton. He's from, he's from South Georgia, I think Alamo, Georgia, or something like that. A super small town, one street light. And he was like the biggest dog fan. And once I joined, that little league team, they were like a family, man. And played offensive lineman my first year, offensive and defensive line, because I didn't know what I was doing. But that second year is when I had the biggest growth and started playing running back and really started understanding the game. And then he also took me my first Georgia game that year as well, my second year. And once I walked into that stadium, saw all the fans, started learning the cheer at kickoff. Like, I remember all those moments, man. And just like it was yesterday, it's like a movie that replays in my head all the time. But once I had that experience, man, it became my obsession. And I knew, like, that's where I wanted to be. That's where I wanted to go. And I made my mind up at 10 years old that's what I was going to do, is be that kid, that next kid out of Snellville that was a household name. That's like a David Pollock or David Green.
So that's a really good transition to my next question, because, you play at Brookwood, you have a great career there. You're 2-time Gwinnett County Defensive Player of the Year. I kind of have a multi-pronged question. One, when did the interest start from colleges? And then two, what was your recruitment experience like? And was the goal always to end up in Athens, or did you seriously consider going other places?
So the process for me, man, it really started after a little bit after my sophomore year, after that previous class had had their signing day. And it started out slow for me, man. I was not, number one, I wasn't even a linebacker per se. Like, I played running back. That's what most people don't know, is my whole entire career before high school, returning kickoffs and punts, and I was scoring touchdowns. Like, that's what I thought was going to be my ultimate position. My favorite players were like Ward Dunn and Marshall Faulk and those guys, man. And then, as I got to high school, didn't get along with my coach my freshman year. He moved me to linebacker and kind of buried me in the depth chart of running back. So I just got frustrated, and I was like, I'm going to hit everything moving. And that's how I started. I developed that mentality at linebacker, just from being so pissed off that I was in that position. And it turned into something that became an identity, where I told myself that I was either going to, be around the ball or make every single play. Like, I just made up my mind that that was going to be my standard. And so that's what got me moved up to varsity after my freshman year at Brookwood. And also, that's what got me interest. So it was never even really my intent to necessarily be the best linebacker out there. I was just really trying to set myself apart and trying to achieve my dream at any cost. And so the interest there, man, after my sophomore year, and even that, when I got moved up to varsity, I had a guy starting ahead of me that was a team captain that was doing great things, man. And it literally took just weeks and weeks and weeks of preparation and faith until I got on the field because he hurt his wrist. Like, that was the story of my career. I was never the guy who was, you know, the star athlete or the guy who was given the starting position right away. It was always like either somebody got hurt ahead of me, somebody messed up ahead of me, or just one of those scenarios. We're down by 3 touchdowns and I got put in and I was just ready and capitalized on the opportunity. So that was really the story of recruiting for me, man, was, you know, after my sophomore year, had a decent season, started getting some interest. And the first school that really came in was like Mississippi State. I think it was like Southern Miss or something like that. It wasn't a big school at all, but just getting those little few interest letters. My first actual call, though, was from Mississippi State. And that was like, wow, I was so shocked because everybody during that time was like, you know, even my own teammates making plays, but you're short. You know, even my own coaches like, Rennie, you know, don't be surprised if they don't come after you pretty quickly. You know, you're undersized and things like that. Like, I remember specific conversations and just, you know, having that chip on my shoulder, man. Every time I'll hear that, it would just make me more motivated. And so I took all of those opinions and I got my ass in the weight room and I got in the film room and I just kept putting forth the work and putting forth the effort. Junior year is when things really started to take off. Like, I had 198 tackles my junior year, and a lot of these tackles were against top-tier competition. So I don't know if you remember a guy named Caleb King.
Yeah.
One running back. Yeah, at that time. Yeah. He played at Parkview. And a lot of the attention I got was because my ability to show up in games like that, going against a guy like a Caleb King, and we shut him down. Yeah, destroyed his ass that game. Like, that was one of my favorite games from high school, man. And, you know, that was how I got on Georgia's radar and all these other teams' radar. And Georgia still was, like, the last school to come in. And when I say, man, I was up there, like, I was in Athens, man, like, all the time, to the point where – and this was, like, before I was even on their radar. So 15, 16 years old, my little league coaches, he was, like, a second father to me. He would check me out of school, and I had one connection to – a couple players up in Athens. Was through my coach at that time, Dickie May, connected me with Des Williams. And at that time, you had Craig, the three-headed monster. You had Craig Lumpkin, you had Danny Ware, you had Thomas Brown. And so Des Williams was the fullback at that time. And so when my coaches connected me with him, and I was going up there, and I was that annoying little brother that just would not go away. And would go up there with my Timberland boots on to give me 2 extra inches and doing whatever I had to do just to get in front of them, man. And, you know, still didn't have a scholarship at that time. This was like 2003, 2004. And, you know, Tech came in, Auburn came in. I went on business there because I told myself, man, if UGA doesn't want me, I'm just going to go to one of these other schools and I'm going to give them hell every year and make sure they regret it. And luckily, like I said, by my junior year, after I had that 198 tackle season, finally got that offer from Georgia. And that's where I always wanted to go. I kind of destroyed my recruiting process because I let everybody know, like, this is where I want to be. And this is my dream. I want to play in front of my teachers and my classmates and, you know, make my community proud and inspire the next generation of athletes who are coming up behind me, man. So that was my recruiting process.
That's a cool story about Caleb King, because we've heard a similar story when we chatted with Aaron Davis. He told a story about, obviously, he had his 2 ACLs in high school, so his recruitment was kind of funny that way. And so when he walked on at Georgia, or prior to walking on at Georgia, he had really good tape against Blake Tibbs, who they had really recruited and had a really good high school career, and he had shut Blake Tibbs down. And so he kind of used that tape to get himself the preferred walk-on offer. So I just love stories like that about guys having a vision about where they want to be and just making it happen. You know, I mean, this kind of leads into some stuff I want to talk to you about later, but I think that's a very entrepreneurial spirit, you know, vision to start with, just to see the dream before anybody else can see it and then just do the things to make it happen. So I love that. So when you started, did you enroll early or did you enroll in the late summer?
Yeah, I enrolled in the late summer, man, and part of, and that's when like things really started picking up recruiting wise. Social media was starting to take off, Rivals, and just all that hype around recruiting was really, really exploding during that time. Around that 05 to 07 is I remember when things like that started to become normalized, like leaving early and enrolling early and things like that. And I told myself, man, like, I'm only going to get to be a high school athlete one time in my life. Like, I think I want to enjoy this. And, you know, I'm honestly glad I didn't make that decision, because it was definitely on the table to be able to leave early and go to Athens and all that. And I was like, man, I'm going to enjoy my teammates. I'm going to enjoy this last semester, enjoy being with my family, enjoy being a high school student, because I just knew like things were going to get crazy. And like I said, I had been to Athens so many times that I kind of had the realization of the fact that like college football was not going to be something easier, just a cakewalk and whatnot. And so I wanted to enjoy the little bit of normalcy that I had left. And so, but my mind was set on making sure that when I got to Athens that I was ready to go. So I was training with the top trainers, man. I was blessed to be surrounded by some amazing gurus, man. Ryan Golden being one of them, who's trained so many Georgia guys during their career, before and after their career when they're getting ready for the NFL. Chip Smith, another legend in the game, who I started with. He's the one who kind of gave me that extra edge, competitive edge, from that like quickness and agility and reaction standpoint. So taking the gifts that I already had and being able to maximize it. So I was ready, man, by the time I had gotten to UGA. And I was also already connected to some NFL guys and some college guys like Jesse Tuggle and another buddy of mine, Stevie Bags, Hannibal Navies. So they really, you know, I went in, man, with a lot of good knowledge, and that time really helped me to prepare.
That makes, I think, your 07 season even more interesting, because I think the trend now is kids enroll early because they want to play early. And so the thinking is, hey, we'll get the bowl practice in and we'll get the full spring in, and hopefully that sets us ahead of the game to then start as a true freshman and play. But the 07 season is obviously a memorable one for a lot of Dawgs fans, and I'm sure it was for you as well. Can you, I guess, share some of your memories from that season and how your transition into a primary role at the linebacker position shaped up?
Yeah, man. The biggest memory I have, and I tell people this all the time, like, you know, fans see the season, but they don't see that preseason. And that's when that when you really earn it, that's when you really win. It's like when no TV cameras are around, no fans are around, nobody's in the stadiums. And that, I can say, was one of the toughest preseasons I've ever been in. Number one, you know, you go up there as a freshman, you don't know what the hell's going on. Like, you're trying to learn the playbook. You're just trying to survive. And on top of that, man, it was, like, so hot. Like, I just remember every day was, like, 100. It was, like, at least 104 to 107 degrees. Like, no lie. And so my feet were just burning. You can see the heat waves rising from the turf on the field, man. And then, you know, you got your helmet on, so it's like a heat box. Like, and then on top of that, like I said, you're confused. And so just even starting out, man, going through training camp and just getting adjusted to the college football life, man, was extremely tough my freshman year. You got study hall, you got to get, you know, 7 a.m., you got to go to class, and this is summertime. Nobody else is on campus. And so going through that, man, and getting the adjustment was one of the biggest phases, man. And, you know, you have those days where you show up late, and so now you got to do discipline runs at like 5:30 in the morning. It's just all types of stuff, man. And being able to overcome that and really grow and progress quickly, man, enough to, you know, not get redshirted, that was like my first hurdle, was just to show them and to show myself that I belonged at University of Georgia. So that was like one of the biggest hurdles, man, because you walk into that locker room, and I don't care how much you've accomplished in high school, it's like you look around and you're like, golly, like, this is crazy. That's like your first shock, is realizing that everybody was a Rennie Kern or better. You know, everybody was number one in their position or number one in the nation coming out. So you have to overcome that mental hurdle of just not being intimidated. And then after that, it's about, okay, I need to get out here, not only compete and not only like learn, but I need to like do extra. I got to go over and above. And even that sometimes doesn't even work. Because, like, I got in there, dedicated myself, but then we get into the season, got, you know, guy starting ahead of me, 6'3", 250 pounds, and, you know, I'm buried in the depth chart, I'm third string, and then there's another mental hurdle, and this is something that you see a lot of guys struggle with, is they've always been the starter, they've always been the man, so can they handle being second string? Can they handle coach not acknowledging them? Can they handle not being in the spotlight? And so I had to battle that, like, and it took weeks and weeks and weeks of me just having faith and believing and, like, having that vision once again. Before anybody knew who Rennie Curran was, before I was ever on any depth chart or, you know, getting any type of stats or any type of plays, I was literally preparing as if I was a starter. So I would go in the weight room. I would go in the film room, you know, early in the morning. I would stay after everybody left. I would watch and I was just devouring film, man, for like at least 2 months. I was putting in that work, paying the dues, watching Tony Taylor, watching Odell Thurman, watching Danny Verdun, Wheeler, like all those guys, man. Just dissecting and devouring film, man, watching how they move, watching their technique, and just going out on the field and practice. I would literally be 20 yards behind the starting defense, and I would be their shadow, and I'll be – when the ball snap, I'm moving just as if I'm in the game. And, you know, guys will make fun of me and I wouldn't even care. I'll just be in my own zone. And like I said, 5, 6, 7 weeks passed. You know, I got to the point where sometimes I was like, man, why'd they even bring me here? Why didn't they redshirt me? And eventually what happened was, just like I said before, guy ahead of me messed up. And it was in the Tennessee game. That's when they had Montario Hardesty and Arian Foster. Yep. And, we were down by 3 touchdowns. I think it was like 35-7, the final score of that game. But yeah, one of the last touchdowns was Montario Hardesty ran a running back wheel. The linebacker was supposed to cover him was a guy who was ahead of me. He blew the coverage and didn't cover him. He scored. And that's when I got the call from the skybox from Coach Jancic. He's like, Rennie, you're in. And got in, man, made a couple plays, made like 1 or 2 TFLs. And that was like my beginnings of showing the coaches that I had what it took, man. And from there, I believe we had the Vanderbilt game, was able to make more plays in that. And then the next game after that was the Florida game, which is where I got my first start, man. So the rest was history.
Yeah, so I feel like 2 magical games from that season are the cocktail party that year. I mean, Florida comes in with all that hype, and it was kind of the coming out party, I think, for that 07 team. Putting up a lot of points. I'll always remember Muhammad Masquaw's long touchdown that day. That play I'll always remember from the Florida game. I felt like that kind of set the tone for that day. I mean, I know that was the Gator Stomp game and all those things, but I just felt like Muhammad's long touchdown really set the tone for what was going to happen the rest of the game, because it was kind of an answer after Florida had tied it. But then I also want to talk to you about the Auburn game. I mean, the blackout that year has become iconic. And when we talked to Asher Allen, one of the things he specifically mentioned was that his main memory from that game was you tackling everything that moved that night. So speak on that game, with that being such a national platform at night and kind of having the game that you did and what that did for your career moving forward at Georgia.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's that point in every player's career, especially early on, where they just have that light bulb moment where, like, everything comes together, where it's like you stop having to really think about the play calls, and now it's becoming second nature. Now you're really able to combine your level of talent with your level of knowledge. And that was when it all started really, really clicking for me, where I really started to become comfortable with knowing that, like, this is my position. Like, I'm not having to worry and look behind my back as, you know, on whether my coaches trusting me to be out there and trusting whether I'm going to be able to know the calls and know my alignments. Like, now I'm just out there having fun. And this was my 19th birthday on top of it. So, like, everything literally was coming together. Yeah. And it was just, man, I'm out there just having fun, just like it's Little League ball again. When you get to that point as a player, man, there's no better feeling. And that's when you can really ball out. That's when you can really just play balls to the wall, man. And so that was that game. And then one of the coolest things about it, and I still get on him to this day, I'm proud of him, man. This guy, he's a really successful training running backs now. Works with guys like Najee Harris and many other top running backs. But Brad Lester was a running back who was with Auburn at that time.
Yeah.
And he actually was a guy that I grew up watching at Brookwood because he played at our rival high school. And he played with like Jeff Francoeur. I mean, they had a dynasty. And they were just destroying folks, including us. They won a lot of three state championships. Never got to play against him, man. But that day, you know, he played. He was the running back for Auburn, one of the running backs. It was him and Ben Tate. And, man, I had one of the best hits on him in my career. Just like one of those hits where, as a linebacker, as a defensive player, you know when you get somebody because you don't even have to wrap up. You just kind of run through them. And so it was one of the best feelings in the world. But, yeah, that game was just, man, the hype around it, going into it, and just what we were able to do, the energy, man, the excitement, just how we were all clicking it on all cylinders and just having fun. That's one of the biggest things I remember from that game is just how much fun it was. And then, you know, once you have a game like that where everybody's excited, you end with the win, everything's going well. Then after that, I mean, you already know what's going on downtown. Like after a game like that, like it just put the icing on the cake, just being able to celebrate my 19th birthday downtown in Athens after a big win like that. I only remember half of it, but it was good times.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love that. Well, so obviously, you know, after the 07 season was, I mean, I think most folks, logical folks would say that if there had been a college football playoff at that time, Georgia would have been in it. And I think at that time, as hot as that team was, probably would have been the favorite to win. I mean, I just don't think anybody that wasn't the system then, you know, go to play in the Sugar Bowl and just wear Hawaii out all night long. And your career continues to ascend through 08 and 09. What was it like, I guess, dealing with the variation in season? It's obviously like a meteoric season in 07, then high expectations in 08, and still a very, very good year, just not what preseason expectations were. And then 09, a lot of change and adjustment because a lot of guys left. So just share what, I guess, the evolution of your career was from a player experience on the team side and then individually as you continue to grow and progress.
Yeah, it was extremely tough, man, because like I said, you put in so much work in the off season and even during the season. And then people don't realize, man, when you take that jersey off, when you're not on the field, you're still a human being. Like you still have things going on. You still have your family. You still have people back home who are dependent on you, things like that, man. Like I became a father my sophomore year after the South Carolina game, you know, like, my whole entire life changed. So when you're dealing with so many things like that, man, and you're putting in so much work on and off the field, like you want to see those results. And the tough thing about it is playing in the SEC, people don't realize like just how small the margin of error is. Like that 2008 season when we lost to LSU and it came down to like that last play where Charles Scott ran a touchdown at the end. I mean, that was literally like I had an offensive lineman who was on, like, basically tackled me on that play, or else I would have made that stop. Like, that's how close it was to us just winning that, being able to win that game. And that's how small the margin of error is. And so when you hear, you know, when you hear like you have a disappointing season or you don't meet those expectations, it's really frustrating just because we all are out there like killing ourselves, man. Like, not only trying to just win a game, but like trying to feed our families, trying to really, you know, just set ourselves up for the future. And so it was definitely tough, man, because we had the talent, we had the ability, but it was like you have a couple of those really close games that might come. I mean, even the Alabama game, like we shot ourselves in the foot so many times, made mistakes and different things like that, but we knew we had the ability to beat them. You know, every team that we lost to, we knew we had the ability to beat them, but it was just like, did we show up that day? Did we execute that day? Did we shoot ourselves in the foot or not? So, you know, when you have seasons like that, man, no matter how much success you have individually, you know, it kind of takes away from it just because you know how much potential you have and where you have the potential to be. Because we started out that season number two, you know, in the nation. And so you know, not being able to get that national championship and be at that high level where we knew it could be, it was, like I said, extremely, extremely tough. But nonetheless, we had some amazing memories that year, extremely talented team. And you know, the biggest thing, win or lose, man, you come away from this game, like the relationship with your teammates, like that's the most powerful thing, the memories that you have, like all those things, that all those moments behind the scenes, man, that like you just think about it, you just laugh. But when we get back together, me and the guys, like we still talk about, like that's what really makes it special, man. Because I say, even if we did, you know, win the national championship and all those things, it still doesn't take away from just those things that really matter most, man. Like I said, the relationships you build, the memories, man, the lessons you learn, all those things.
Can you give us some insight? Because you obviously, after your junior season, made the choice to move on to the NFL. And I kind of have two questions about this, because my understanding is, if I did my research right, you made a contract with your mom that if you made that choice, you had to go back to Georgia and get that degree finished. So talk to me about that first.
Oh, yeah, man. Like, well, at that time, man, like I said, it a lot of that decision had to do just with where I was in life, you know, and where my family was, man, our family situation. Like at this time, man, my dad, so my seventh, eighth grade year, my dad had lost his business. He owned a shoe repair franchise. And that was how we were able to move into the suburbs. And he was able to help a lot of my family who were going through the civil war in Liberia. And once he lost that, man, we just fell into, like, we never really recovered financially. So from like eighth grade till basically I made it to the NFL, my mom was paying all the bills. And, you know, my dad worked odd jobs. Like he was a janitor. He was a taxi cab driver, and he almost got killed doing that. Like literally had somebody pull a gun, put it to his neck, pull the trigger, and like the gun got jammed. Like it's only God that saved him. Yeah. Worked in a mental institution. I mean, he was just doing anything he could just to survive. Worked at Walmart. The whole time I was at Georgia, he was working at Walmart. Mom's a nurse, paying all the bills. His checks were getting garnished from that business he had lost. And so I'm just like, man, I'm tired of struggling. Like, you know, here I am on the field. Like, you know, all these great things are going on. But when I take that jersey off, like I said, I'm having to, even with the scholarship, this is what people don't realize. That even with the scholarship, you still have life. You still have things that come up. I have a child to feed, right? Daycare is not cheap. You know, daycares, diapers, formula is not cheap. And then on top of that, I'm taking out student loans and basically giving that to my family to help. Like I'm taking my Pell Grant, splitting that in half and, you know, paying whatever I have to pay for myself, but then splitting that in half and giving that money to my family, man, to help them. And so that was a huge reason why I had to make that decision. Not because I just wanted to go to the NFL and want to be at that level, but literally I was trying to change the trajectory of my family. Like, and that's how real it is when we're out there. It's not just a game. Like, this is life. This is legacy changing, you know. And I was the first person in my family to be in this position to even do this, to even have a career starting out making anything near six figures. So, you know, that's what it came down to. And even though, you know, my parents were all for it, my mom, that's how she got to this country, was through education. So she's like, yes, I want you to go. I want you to achieve your dreams. I want you to do things for us. But you got to promise me you're going to come back and get this degree. Because she always knew that, you know, that was something that they could never take away from me. And so signed the contract, man. And, you know, found myself back at UGA back in end of 2012, 2013. After, you know, coaching staff changes, and I know we're going to talk about this, but, you know, found myself back there, and I earned that thing, man. I earned that Terry College of Business degree with my blood, sweat, and tears, man. I would come back every offseason as I was in the NFL and the CFL, take one to two classes at a time, and it took me about 5 years after I left UGA to finish my degree, but I got it, and it's one of the greatest accomplishments in my life.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing that story, because that was going to be one of my follow-ups. Is I'm so interested in insight as it pertains to the choice to make the professional leap. And to your point, I think it's a subject that doesn't get its fair share of nuance. I think I think it's just looked at as a very black and white decision. And there's so much gray in it and so many factors that go into it. And, you know, we've talked a lot on this show. I think because of the way the current college marketplace is set up, if you fault a kid for making the choice to go to the pros to try and support his family, I just don't know if I could ever see eye to eye with that person because I don't understand that. You know, you have the whole point in kids going to college is to set themselves up for professional success.
Right. And so why else do you go to college?
Yeah. So if a kid has gotten to the point where he set himself up or herself up for professional success, we wouldn't have these arguments or say a kid should stay if the New York Philharmonic was telling them to come play the clarinet for the Philharmonic, right? We'd go, oh, this is awesome. They should go right now. I don't understand. Well, I do understand because it's driven by, I think, greed for the people that aren't actually involved in it. But that's a whole nother conversation. But I don't understand why we're not just happy that the kid that's at these universities is escalating. And
Right.
But anyway, so I'm very appreciative that you share that story.
Yeah, man. And I'll add to that, man. I think, you know, as much as I love the fans and everything, at the end of the day, we're entertainment. You know, let's be honest. And because we are entertainment, there's that disconnect in terms of our real lives, like who we really are. Like when we take that jersey off, like a lot of us, man, we're that 1% of 1% that come out of our communities. Like I tell people all the time, we're like that Charlie in the Chocolate Factory. We're all like little Charlies who are trying to get that golden ticket in a lot of cases. You know, you have some who come from very fortunate backgrounds, but a lot of us, we are the first. We're the first to come out of our community. We're the first to in our families to achieve this level of success. And so literally we have so much riding on our backs. And like you said, man, if it's any other scenario in college, nobody would question it. If it's a student in the business school or in a journalism school, you know, and Chick-fil-A says, we want to hire you right now. We want to put you in an executive position and pay you six figures after their junior year. They're not going to think twice about that. If a kid in a journalism school is hired by ESPN or NBC and they're like, we want to pick you up right now, and we'll pay you six figures and we'll take it, you know, it's not going to be no question. Like, you know, it's no, and nobody's going to fault them. But because, like you said, because this is, there's so much loyalty and because there's that entertainment factor where nobody is thinking about the longevity of that athlete 10 years, 20 years down the line. That's where you get that kind of pushback and everything. And I get it. Like the fans are extremely passionate. I was a passionate fan once, you know, being a 10-year-old kid, 11-year-old kid, to where, you know, I wasn't, you know, I looked at Thomas Davis, I looked at David Green, but I wasn't thinking about what was their life like off the field when I'm not watching them on TV, you know, the things that they're having to deal with as human beings, just trying to make it out here. So I totally understand both sides of it.
Yeah, that's a great point too. There's a shelf life to athletics that is not there with other professions that college kids are going to school for, right? Like we have this conversation all the time with our kids about, like, I played baseball in college, my wife played soccer, and those have a shelf life. You only get to play and enjoy those for a certain amount of time. And then it's over with. And so that's why we always try to encourage them to pursue things that they can then enjoy their whole lives, right? Whether that be music or a sport like golf that you can play that's not age and health dependent to a certain degree, right? So yeah, I think that's a great point. And so I do want you to kind of talk about the excitement that goes along with the draft experience, because most folks that listen to this podcast have never had that. So share what the lead up to that was like, and then what draft day was like for you and your family.
Man, the best way to explain draft day is like, I haven't been married before. I'm getting ready. You know, I'm preparing myself. Any ladies listening, I'm here. No, I'm just kidding. But the best way to kind of explain the draft and preparing is like, it's like married. It's like, you've been preparing yourself for this one moment to commit to this, you know, this entity that is a lifelong, I mean, it's feeling like it's going to be a lifelong commitment, even though it only lasts like on average 3 to 4 years. But when you're preparing, man, you're putting your all into it. Like, you are fully committed. Every single aspect of your life is dedicated towards this one moment. And this is what you've been working on your whole entire life. For me, you know, started at 10 years old. You know, you don't get into the game like a game like football and work as hard as you do unless you have it in the back of your mind that you want to be at that top level, that you want to eventually get married, right, to that,
right,
that team. And so when it finally comes, man, like, you don't know. That the weird thing about it, though, is you don't know who you're going to get married to. So you're just sitting there.
It's like an arranged marriage.
Right, arranged marriage. Exactly. So you're just sitting there, man. And after you go through the combine, which is an extremely stressful process in itself, the most stressful job interview you could ever imagine, man. Like, people, you know, in the corporate world have no idea just how, you know, you look at different interviews where they have to go through different phases. They have to, you know, they might have to go visit, and then they might have to do an in-person interview and then a telephone call. But there's nothing, I mean, I've never seen anything like this. Military, I believe, is the only thing that can really compare to like what we experienced going through the combine, just in terms of the level of evaluation. Like, I'm talking about they evaluate every single aspect of you, every single inch of your body, every single aspect of your mind, from physical to mental to, you know, to wanting to know evaluating your blood, your heart scan, like everything, doing the interviews, which are crazy in itself. And then from that to the pro day, to the team visits, all that stuff. And then eventually, you know, you get to draft day after everything, and you're just sitting there, man. You've given your all. Like I said, you've put your best into this. And then you're sitting there, you're watching the TV screen, and you're seeing the names start to come in, right? You're seeing guys start to get drafted. And it's like, some guys, you're like, oh, man, congrats to him. Awesome player, awesome career. Then you start seeing guys like Southwest Idaho, and you're like, what? What? And then you see Northwest, you know, Oklahoma, and I'm like, what? Where did this guy come from? Or I didn't even know this person existed. And that's when your heart start being fast. You're like, oh, man, I don't know where I'm gonna go, where I'm gonna get drafted. That's when you start to really realize, like, this thing is a business. Like, it's no feeling. Nobody cares about your feelings. Nobody cares that it's your dream. Like, it's a business. And so for me, I sat down, and it was, I don't care where you get drafted at, it's still gonna be like the longest time span of your life. So for me, it happened the second day, and I was like towards the end, like literally one of the last picks of that second day. So I was literally watching the TV screen. Like, that first day was cool because I knew I wasn't going to get picked. That second day, I got a call from a team from the Colts. I'll talk about it now because it's been 10 years now. But I got a call from the Colts, and they're like, man, we know you know, you're anxious. We know you're ready to play. We got a pick in the second round. We're going to try to get you, man. So just hold tight. And so I'm like, okay, cool. And so, man, that second pick, second round pick came up, and I'm sitting there, I'm looking at my phone, my heart's beating off fast, and then all of a sudden, nothing happens. And I look up at the TV screen, Roger Goodell comes up, and he's like, with the whatever pick, 92nd pick of the second round, Indianapolis Colts select Patrick Anger, Iowa. And I was like, wow, that's how y'all do it. No callback, no nothing, no explanation. It was just like, kept it moving. And then now I'm just sitting there like, I don't know what's going to happen next, man. I'm just like, you know, the picks just continue rolling in. Other teams that had interviewed me before, they picked guys. Like, another team that was on the radar that I thought could potentially choose me was the San Francisco 49ers. I went out there and visited with them when they had Mike Singletary.
Yeah.
Him being another short linebacker.
How great would that have been, right?
Oh, man. I was like, this is perfect fit. He's a short linebacker. I'm a short linebacker. This is all good. Yeah. You know, Patrick Willis is out there. He could be my mentor. That pick came up. They took Navarro Bowman. I was like, dang. And then, man, a couple picks after that, sitting there, man, I'm ready to just hang it up. I'm like ready to just call it a night, go up to my room, go to sleep, get ready for the next day. And then like right before this third round is about to end, phone starts ringing and 615 number, pick it up. It's Jeff Fisher. He's like, Rennie, I know you've been waiting for a long time, but welcome to the Tennessee Titans. And the whole time, my whole entire life is just flashing before my eyes, man. Like, just everything from childhood to all the reps, man, all the times I was doubted, all the times I, you know, went to the weight room early in the morning and stayed in the film room after everybody was done. Like, all the time my family struggled, like, everything just flashed, man. And, you know, as I'm talking to him, everybody's getting excited, everybody's crying, like, all that stuff, man, just... It's like I said, it's like Christmas. It's like a mix between Christmas and a marriage. Like, it just was the best feeling in the world. And then after that, man, after I talked to Jeff Fisher and the defensive coordinator, Chuck Cecil, and the pro personnel guy, and in the midst of all the excitement and whatnot, I hang up the phone after talking to them. And the minute I hang up the phone, I look up at the TV screen. My name is flashing on the screen. Rennie Curran, University of Georgia, Tennessee Titans. Third round pick. And then I looked back down at my phone, bro, and no lie, it was like my phone hit the jackpot. Like, I had literally like 300 text messages come in all at once. My voice mailbox went full in like 2 seconds. It went from like empty to full in 2 seconds. And phone, yeah, it was just crazy, man. Just a surreal experience, man. And I was just so thankful. You know, all the people, man, like I said, that just like helped me on my journey, because you don't get to a point like that, man, without this strong village, a strong community. So like from my little league coach to my pastors to my chaplains to the teachers, man, like I was just like just thankful, man. And it was the best experience, one of the best experiences of my life.
Well, how great is that too, with your family being in the Atlanta and Gwinnett area? You know, Nashville's that's a drivable trip, so like it's not right. Even that you would be so far, because like San Francisco would have been awesome for all the reasons that you listed, but you'd have been a country away, right?
Right, right.
And
right.
So it's cool from a proximity perspective as well. So what, yeah. tell the listeners what the main differences are from the athletic experience as a college player versus yeah. what it becomes when you're in the league. Because I think there's a lot of disparity between what people know about those two experiences.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many differences. One of the biggest difference, man, is just the knowledge gap. So, you know, when you get into college, most guys are around the same range of age. So, you know, you get into college, you're typically around 17, 18 years old. The oldest guys around 21, right, to 22 years old. You might have a guy right. who comes back in that's, you know, former military or a guy that played another sport that went pro and now he's coming back. Like we had Josh Murray who did that, who played pro baseball, but he was yeah. still only like 23, 24. When you get to the league, bro, like that age and knowledge gap is so ridiculous. Like the guy ahead of me when I got to the Titans, Will Witherspoon was 32 years old. I'm 32 right now. He was like 32, 33 years old. And so the amount of knowledge, the amount of experience, like I would never be able to like surpass that. Like, I don't care how many reps I get, whatever. So that's one of the main things is the fact that you're not just playing with guys who like you're going to go out and hang out with afterwards. Like these are grown men who have right. families,
right.
who live, like this has been their profession. They've played with these guys for years. They know the vet moves. Like it's just different. So even if you stay in that weight room, a guy can just understand like, how to take a certain angle or how to just nuance a certain play. And then even off the field, the guys will know, you know, they've already been in the game in terms of just how to manage themselves, man, how to manage being like having a financial advisor, an agent, knowing how to conduct themselves business-wise and all those things. So you're having to learn that so quickly, man. And not only that, just the change in lifestyle is another thing.
Yeah.
In college, you don't have that many options, right? You got, if your parents are struggling, you got that Pell Grant, you know you're going to get that. The money that you get from the scholarship, you don't really see unless you're living off campus and you get like a stipend when you live off campus that is basically like an offset of the money that you would receive if you were living in the dorms, right? So yep. You get a little bit of money here and there. Well, you get to the league, and now you got, you know, my first installment was $90,000 for my signing bonus. So you get that in your bank account, man, and you've never seen that kind of money.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you got all these different options, man, that you never had before. And you got, it's like, you know, fruit flies or something. Like, you got people that are coming that were never around before, who smell money, who smell opportunity. And so knowing how to navigate those things brings on a whole new challenge, man. Just, and you're still only like 22 to 24 years old, and your brain isn't even fully developed, but you're having to now become basically a CEO of your own company, which I don't care who you are. Take any kid coming out of college and put them in a CEO position and watch how successful they're going to be. So, you know, just those things psychologically is one of the biggest hurdles. And you get to, I tell people all the time, you get to that rookie mini camp and training camp or whatnot, and they hand you a freaking playbook that is thick. Like, that thing is thick. You got about, you know, 6 to 12 different defenses that you install on a daily basis. And they install it for about 1.5 to 2 hours. You're watching the film, you're going over, you know, those play calls. And then when you get on that field, they expect you to know that thing and be a pro, like run it like you've been doing it your entire life. And
right.
If you can't get that thing down, or if you can't, if you're not, you know, proficient in one-on-one man-to-man drills, ain't no coach saying, oh, let's meet up so I can go over this with you. Nah, you're going home. Like, you're getting that plane ticket home. And it gets very, very real. Unless you're a draft pick and they've invested in you, if you're a free agent, like, your margin of error, once again, is extremely slim. So if you mess up a couple times, like, I saw guys get sent home because they didn't do a good job in man-to-man drills, or because they messed up a couple times, you know, with their play calls and whatnot, man. That's how tough it is. And then the other thing that you see, man, is just the unfortunate demise of guys. Like, that's having to accept that reality that this is a business. Like, you guys are literally like Pokemon cards, like horses in a horse race.
Yep.
So you get traded and discarded and replaced like it's nothing, man. Like I said, unless you're a draft pick, that's the only way that you're really safe. If you're not a draft pick, if you're not a guy who's like a face of the franchise, like a Matt Ryan or whatnot, like, you have to look over your back every day. You can never get comfortable. And, you know, that was one of the toughest things to accept, because you can be as good as you want to be. And sometimes it just comes down to the salary cap, or sometimes it's about, you know, a guy like a Matt Ryan, or like, I'll give you my example, Chris Johnson. You rushed, you remember, I don't know if you remember that year.
Yeah.
2,000 yards.
2K. Yeah. 2K CJ.
Yeah. 2K CJ. Right. So he needs after he gets that 2K, he needs a bigger contract. And so that means that they have to cut some guys off, man. They have to clear room to make room for that salary cap. And so that means some guys who are good enough are going home.
Yeah.
And that happens all the time. And fans don't realize that. Like, it's a lot of times has nothing to do with your performance. It's just about, we need to balance this checkbook.
Yeah.
So, like I said, if you like a Pokemon car, you like a horse, you know, a horse in a horse race. So they'll get rid of you, bring somebody else in who's cheaper. And that's why you see a lot of undrafted free agents getting picked up. Not because they're such amazing players. Nah, they cheat. It's cheaper to keep them.
Cheap. Than it is that's to right. keep
that second, third year guy who was a third round draft pick, because you have to continue to like pay them at that level. So those are the things that, man, I didn't know going in. And most of us don't know that when you love the game, it is so disheartening when you realize how much of a business it is and how many things are out of your control, no matter how hard you work. Like, the year, I'll leave with this, like, the year I got cut from the Titans, I led the team in tackles. Like, that was the first time I led the team in tackles and did everything I could and still got cut.
Yeah, so that brings up a follow-up question. How difficult is that mentally to reconcile when, you know, I'm a big proponent of control the controllables, right?
Yeah.
I'm gonna control all the things I can control, and the things I can't, I'm not gonna waste any energy on that.
Right.
So to your point, there's only so many pieces of the puzzle that you get to control as a player in the NFL.
And so how do you reconcile knowing, look, I couldn't have done anything else. And, you know, there's nothing about it I could change that would have made the scenario change. I just have to be kind of, I guess, at peace with that, knowing that I controlled the controllables, and then you just keep it moving, right? Like, I'm just going to move on to the next opportunity, I guess. But that is a much easier said proposition than done, right?
Oh, yeah. No, it's extremely hard, and I still have days where I'm watching a game on you know, NFL Sunday or whatnot, and I'm just thinking to myself, man, dang, what could have been? You know, I always knew I was good enough to play at this level. I'm watching guys, even now, that I played against, who are dominating. I'm like, well, I played with this guy. I know I'm good enough. So that is one of the toughest parts about it, is just knowing your potential, knowing what you could accomplish. But at the same time, like, I got to that point where it became more than just about being on the field. It was about becoming the best version of myself. And so for me, I had to redefine what success was and what winning was for me. And as long as I knew I did everything to maximize the opportunity, and like I said, to become the best version of myself, then I had to just let the chips fall where they may. And then I'm a man of faith. So I truly believe that, like, you know, there was a reason why I didn't stay 10 years in the NFL. There's a reason why opportunities didn't work out. Like, what I do now as a speaker, as an author, as a, you know, leadership and business coach, is so much more meaningful and so much more impactful and fulfilling than anything I could do on a football field. Because at the end of the day, if I'm on that football field, no matter how many hits I make, I'm just entertainment. But now I get to, you know, I get to be an influencer. You know, I get to be an influencer. So those are some of the things that helped me overcome just knowing that there were those things that I couldn't control, man. It's just the knowing that I left everything on that field. And once I knew I did that, man, whether it was at University of Georgia, like, can't nobody tell me that Rennie Curran did not leave everything, his whole entire heart on the field. Every single play, I was going balls out as hard as I could, maximizing this 5'10 and a half, 5'11 frame to the best of my ability, throwing my body at offensive linemen and whoever else came my way. So, like, just knowing and understanding that I did every single thing that I could, you know, that gives me peace, man. And I can look myself in the mirror as a man. I think that's what we should all strive for, just in life in general, knowing that we made the best of all of our opportunities, anything that was given to us, we went into it with the right attitude, whether it worked out or not. That's, you know, whether people treated you right or not, that's, you know, it doesn't matter. It's all about how you approach the situation and all those things, man. And like I said, once you can look at yourself in the mirror, at the end of the day, to me, you should have nothing but joy in your heart and nothing but gratitude.
I heard an interview with you once where you talked about your decision to go to Georgia. And I thought it was really compelling how you framed it, because you had mentioned that you always knew you wanted to be in Atlanta eventually. And you knew that Georgia would provide a couple things via your football journey. One, there's an enormous alumni base of Georgia graduates in the greater metro Atlanta area. And number two, every single quote unquote fan that you're earning on the football field could one day then turn into a business contact. And that struck me because, number one, I think for any of us that were 18 and 19, that's a very forward thinking approach to take. And I think it speaks to your entrepreneurial spirit. I think in some ways it's not something you can manufacture. That's something that's a little bit innate. So has that always been the goal for you to become an entrepreneur, to own your own businesses, to have dominion over the course of your life and how you're utilizing your gifts?
Yeah, that definitely an innate thing. And something that I also saw exemplified growing up is, like I said, my dad, man, when both my parents came here, my dad didn't have his immigration papers right away, his citizenship right away. That was the way that he was able to empower himself, was through entrepreneurship. So he was able to, he had a friend that he knew from Iberia that had developed a skill of fixing shoes, shoe repair. So we're talking designer shoes, cowboy boots, so high-end shoes.
Yeah.
Not just your guy who's at an airport, you know, shining shoes, but, you know, a very unique skill. And so through that, you know, he developed that skill, and him, my mom, and my grandfather got enough money together to where he could buy into a franchise, Hacky Shoe Repair, and everything. And so through that was, you know, I got to see literally with my own eyes, see him have the ability, even with it being an immigrant with a thick accent, man, being able to be in control of his own destiny, being able to, you know, like I said, help my cousins, uncles, aunties come over here as refugees, start a whole new life, empower themselves. And then, you know, I just saw him even just in moments where I was like, man, wow. Like seeing him deal with customers and like not take any shit from anybody like that as I was like 7 years old, you know, just watching him tell a cut, like, if you don't like this, you can leave. Like just, you know, being in control of your own destiny, man, that always struck me. And then my dad, he was always somebody who, he was a man's man. Like he worked extremely hard and just would not take, was relentless in how he approached things and just took pride, man. When he wasn't fixing shoes, like he would make sure that we had the best of things. You know, he would make sure like he just, you know, he didn't do, there's a lot of things he didn't do right, but just setting that standard, man, and that work ethic and the values that he brought. And this is a man who didn't, he didn't have a father in his life. Like my dad didn't meet his father until he was my age. And he grew up, like when I went back to where he grew up and saw like the things that he had to overcome, I had no excuses. I mean, this is a man who grew up, like it's one thing to talk about growing up in like a rural area here, in poverty here, and another thing when you talk about poverty and having a single parent home in a third world country, like that's a whole different animal.
Right.
And so to see him be able to power himself through entrepreneurship, that's something that always stuck with me, and was just like something I wanted to emulate and something I wanted to do. And so my entrepreneurship journey started as early as like 10, 11 years old. Like my dad would have me mow the lawn at my house. And so, you know, I thought to myself, man, you know, how can I get to a point where I don't have to ask my parents for money? I don't have to ask for things. Cause like I said, this time the Civil War was going on, they're helping a lot of our family. So the last thing I wanted to do was ask them for anything. So I got that lawnmower, started going around my neighborhood. And I remember just how it felt to make $100 in one day mowing lawns, you know, and just being 11 years old. And you know, when you're 11, 12 years old, that's a fortune.
That's a lot of money, man. That's a lot of baseball cards to buy, man.
Yeah, exactly, man. So just being able to, you know, make hard earned money, honest money, and being able to, you know, be empowered, man, through adding value to people and learning that skill, man, knocking the door, being a salesman, that young of an age, and hearing no, you know, all those different things just became ingrained in me. And I was able to take that onto the football field with me, because people don't realize recruiting is, you got to be very entrepreneurial. So I had to go and I had to get with one of my teammates and their dad, one of my teammates' dad, to make my recruiting film. That's no different than, you know, making a marketing ad, right?
Right.
And then I had to go to University of Georgia and get in front of Coach Rick. And that was my way of sales. Like now that I look back at it, and sales and promotion. So all this time, man, it was about, a lot of it was about having that entrepreneurial mindset for me, being that guy who was undersized, knowing that I couldn't just take that conventional route. Like I had to be innovative. I had to think outside the box. And so, I only worked, man, like two actual jobs my whole entire life, basically, man. Like I was worked in a moving company. Moving stuff, and then I worked in a warehouse. My little league coach got me that job, and like after those experiences, I was like, man, I'll never work for anybody else again in my life, man. Unless I'm working with them, you know, as a consultant or as a speaker in what I do now.
I'm interested to hear your perspective on this via not only your own personal journey, but also what you see in your business life now as an author and a speaker. One of the interesting things for me about the athletic world is whether you finished playing in high school, whether you finished playing in college, or whether you finished playing professionally. Athletes, I think, find their identity in the space where they were athletically successful. Right. And I think it is a gigantic transition once that avenue of their life is no longer active and present.
Yeah.
And I think it's a big struggle and a big fight to then find who they are and who they're supposed to be now that that chapter is closed. Was that a challenge for you? And have you seen that in your work since you retired?
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. Any athlete who said it's not a challenge is going to be either they're lying or they never loved the game. Like, I think those are the only two ways where, you know, they're not going to admit that it's a struggle. If you were just out there doing it just because you were good enough and just because you were trying to please your parents or just trying to please people around you and be a part of it, then I could see how it's not that really that much of a transition. But if you really love the game and you really gave your all and you really dedicated yourself to it and you really bought into the culture and bought into the idea of being a part of a team and bought into, you know, the relationships, and you love running out the tunnel and you love just studying the game and really becoming great, then it's an extreme, extreme struggle after you're done. And, you know, our minds are like, we're habits of, or creatures of habit, right? And right. So even after you take that jersey off, even after you remove yourself, there's just part of your mind and your wiring that is still attuned to being an athlete. That's never going to go away, especially the fact that you're doing it in your developmental years. You know, when you start from young, and I think that's what makes us different from like military guys. Like, military guys start a little bit older. I mean, they're still in that point when they start, when their brains aren't fully developed. But the fact that we start from like our childhood, like, it is literally your identity. Like, it's not no, like, you know, maybe ifs and buts about it. This is like part of you. And so, you know, I look at it multiple ways. The fact that, like, when you take that jersey off for the last time, and the fact that that's part of your identity, it's like part of you dies.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's the first thing, is like understanding that you have to go through a mourning process. Just like if you lost somebody in real life, there's the phases of grief, right? You have to go, you know, I don't know all the steps of grief, but I mean, I'm sure you know it, you know, the acceptance and the denial and all those phases of grief. Like, you literally go through that. And then another thing that I realized about it is it's no different than a person who's going through their midlife crisis. Like, the fact that you have to literally start all over from scratch and rebuild. Like, no matter if you had another thing that you were working on or whatever, like, this thing is such a big part of your life, because when you look at the whole entire picture and the experience, it's like, you know what time you're supposed to wake up in the morning. You know what time you're supposed to be in the weight room, the film room. Like, your whole day is planned out. You know, you have a staff around you. You got your coach, your trainers. Like, you have this whole entire world created that is now gone. So you have to pick up the pieces and build from scratch. And that alone is traumatizing, because it's not like when you're done, they say, here's your team for life. You don't get a life coach and a life trainer and a person who helps you with your meal plan in your regular life. I'm like, nah, you on your own, which is completely different than everything you've experienced up till then. You've always been a part of the team. You've always had a coach. You've always had somebody to tell you what to lift in the weight room. So just even navigating that is extremely tough. So yeah, man, it was tough. And I have the biggest thing that's helped me is, number one, is I found something that gives me that same feeling that I had on the field. And number two, you know, I tried to recreate those structures that I had. And I think as an athlete, we have to do that. We forget that, right?
Yep.
When we're done, we all try to go at it, like, you know, in a way that we were never wired to do. We were never successful as athletes because we did things on our own, right? Or because we didn't have a coach. And so what's different now? Like, I have to have mentors. I have to coach. Even if I don't have a coach, I have to coach myself. I have to review, you know, my performance on a weekly basis. I have to have an agenda, right? An itinerary I have to challenge myself. I have to compete at something. And so being able to recreate that has now given me, man, just so much more life, so much more fulfillment. And I'm able to now teach other athletes and other business leaders. It's the same thing with people in the business world as well, too. It's no different. But I'm able to help people improve their performance, improve as leaders, improve their business and overall life through what I've been able to learn.
First off, I think that's beautiful language around that question. I think that's a great way to frame that, especially the piece about mourning that loss. Because
yeah.
I think there is so much truth in that. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of former athletes could take a lot from that and apply it to their own lives, which in all honesty, I think is a great endorsement of what you're doing, right? Like what you're trying to do with your business and the way you're trying to reach people. Cause I just think that's so valuable. And to that point, tell our listeners how they can reach you, book you, all those type things. If they want you to come work with their company, with their team, with them as individuals from a mentor and coaching perspective, tell them how they can do that.
Yeah, the easiest way is through my website, RennieKern.com, and there you'll be able to find out about what I do as a speaker, keynote speaker, do a lot of presentations on leadership, team building, performance, diversity, inclusion. And then on the coaching side, you'll be able to find information on that as well. I work with a lot of small business owners, recent grads, and others who are trying to navigate their careers, also helping individuals build or expand their personal brand. You know, though, if anybody's trying to get into public speaking, I can help you there or write your first book. And then I also work independently with a couple of different organizations, including John Gordon, the writer of Energy Bus,
yeah,
and several other books. Yeah, work with him, man, and a few other organizations. So, yeah, RennieKern.com is the easiest way. I'm also active on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter as well. So I'm always open to helping anybody, man, and mentoring as well, if there's any young athletes who are your listeners, man. So I appreciate the plug.
Well, look, I'm just going to say this. If y'all have listened to this entire conversation with Rennie and you don't see the enormous value that he could provide you individually or provide to your organization, then I'm sorry, I can't help you. I'll just put it that way. Well, look, Rennie, I certainly appreciate you spending time with us. And we're going to close today. We close all our interviews the same way. We do something called the Smart 16, which is just kind of a little bit of an homage to Coach Smart. And it's just 16 kind of quick hitting questions just to get to know you a little bit better. Okay.
For sure.
All right. So what's your middle name?
Middle name is Flomo, F-L-O-M-O, and it means protector.
Oh, I love that. I love that. All right, who was your favorite teammate at Georgia?
Oh man, that's
the I ain't trying to. I'm not trying to get you in trouble or anything.
Yeah, man. Honestly, Danelle Ellerby was one of my favorite teammates at Georgia. That was my guy, man. He was a dog. Loved playing next to him, and a guy I could always depend on. A guy that I knew if things hit the fan, like, you know, that's who I want, man. That's who I want in the foxhole with me, like the military guys say. Yeah.
What's your favorite game that you ever played in as a dog?
Definitely it's between the Florida game from 07 and the UJ Auburn blackout game.
What is your favorite rivalry that Georgia has?
I think the South Carolina game, man. Always early in the season, it always sets the tone. And then when I was playing, man, it came down to a couple plays, like few last plays in 08 and 09. Both of the games I played in, I was able to do something big to help us win. It's just something about those games that just I showed up.
So, plus, yeah, it's never a bad thing to beat Coach Spurrier.
Yeah, not at all. See him slam his visor down and all that good stuff.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. All right. What's your favorite away stadium in the Southeastern Conference?
Man, favorite away stadium. Definitely, I say Jacksonville, man. Just, you know, going down there, man. The hype around the game, just it's exciting, man. You feel like a rock star when you go down there, especially when you're having a good season. You know you're about to get that win. It's nothing like it.
What's the loudest game you ever played in at Georgia?
Man, I think it was that Auburn blackout game when we came out in those black jerseys, man. It was like a small earthquake in Athens. It was
nuts. Yeah.
It was nuts. Between that and 09 when we played South Carolina, and it was like, you know, fourth quarter, 10 seconds left in game, and, you know, they needed that score, and I batted down the pass, man. That was one of the loudest games I played in.
You get to choose the headlining act at the Georgia Theater. Who do you choose?
Outkast.
Love that. Yeah. All right, you are at the world's largest outdoor cocktail party as a spectator to see the Dogs run roughshod all over the Gators. What is the cocktail that you're mixing?
I'm going to keep it simple, just vodka cranberry.
I like it. Keep the juice flowing. I like that. Yeah. All right, you're back in Athens for one meal. What's your favorite place to eat in Athens?
Man. This one called Porterhouse. Porterhouse is between Porterhouse and Inoko's.
Okay. I like it. All right. When you were playing, did you have any game day superstitions?
Oh, man. I just love to have all my uniform, my socks, everything laid out neatly, man. Like, that was my thing. It made me feel like a superhero. Like, you know, when Batman rolls up to his version of his locker, but everything's just like super nice and pristine. Like that, it's just, you know, like you about to go to war, man. That's what I love.
What is your favorite Sanford Stadium pregame tradition? Whether it's a dog walk, lone trumpeter, Larry Munson coming over the airwaves to address Bulldog Nation, Redcoat Marching Band, forming the arch at the middle of the field. What's your favorite pregame tradition?
Definitely, without a doubt, the dog walk. I mean, that's something, man. Especially if you're a kid that, you know, grows up watching the Bulldogs, and you get to experience it as a child, and then you roll up, man. And even before that, like, just riding up on the bus, man, and just I would always have my headphones on, listening to, like, some Jeezy or some Outkast or something like that, but just that bus ride coming to the dog walk as you're riding through Athens, you're just reflecting on, like, you know, for me, I was reflecting on everything, man, my childhood, my dreams, like what I'm going to do in the game. You're seeing the fans tailgating, the just atmosphere, everything leading up to that. And you roll up to that dog walk, and by then you hype, man, like the bus is rocking. Everybody's just dialed in and ready to go. You put the work in. You know all your assignments, and you just focus. And then you get out there, man. You see, you know, your family's out there at the dog walk. You see the young kids who were just like you. The fans are showing love, man. So just that whole entire experience, the buildup is what I love the most.
I think I know the answer to this one, but black jerseys, yes or no?
Definitely yes. Definitely yes, man. Love switching things up.
What is the loss you're still not over?
That LSU game, our 08 season, was a tough one. That was a tough one. I hate the fact that they beat us, of course, at home. And, you know, I'm like, if I had just got that freaking offensive lineman off me a little bit faster, I would have made the tackle and, you know, would have been in a different situation. So that was a tough one. And, I mean, I played my heart out that game, but those last couple plays where Charles Scott scored at the end, that one eats me up big time, just because, you know, I know I got held and I know there was nothing I could do about it, but, you know, it still was like, dang, I should have done more.
What is your order at the varsity?
Man, I really don't even eat the varsity like that, but if I did, it would just be like a basic hamburger, just something. Like, I wouldn't really order from there. I mean, I hate to say it. Sorry to all the varsity fans. Like, it's decent, but I would typically go there if I was invited, you know, or had an appearance there.
All right, there ought to be a constitutional amendment outlawing noon kickoffs. Yes or no?
Yeah, I definitely don't like noon kickoffs, man. As a player, like, when you, it just throws everything off, man. Like, you got to prepare so much earlier. Everything is accelerated. And then by the time you look, like, when you are actually in tune into the game, it's already almost over, like, by the time you've adjusted mentally. So, yeah, I would definitely outlaw that. Only night games.
Well, when you were there, y'all were staying at Lake Lanier, weren't you? So like, it wasn't a short trip into Athens either.
Yeah, exactly. So we're coming in Lake Lanier probably like, if it was 12 o'clock game, that means we're leaving like, you know, we're up by like 7-8 in the morning or something. It just makes for a really, really long day. And then you're, like I said, you're not really that adjusted mentally. I don't care, especially if you're young, you're not used to it. It just can kind of throw things off. You get started off a lot of times slow, and you know, the hype isn't there as much. I mean, it's just something about those morning games that's just not that appealing.
All right. College football playoff, expand to 8 or find how it is.
I definitely think it should expand to 8, for sure. There's always that argument of the team who is, they don't have a strong schedule, and they're able to be undefeated. So they want to prove themselves. And I think if you were to expand that, it would give more teams like that the opportunity to really show if they're good enough or not.
Yeah, that's kind of me and Boss's opinion too, is that expansion wouldn't be a bad thing. And I think it removes the natural issue of having 5 power conferences and one's right. going to be left out. I just feel like there's such a power struggle when it comes to that. So,
exactly.
Well, that's the smart 16, Rennie. I appreciate you indulging us with that. And, hey man, we are beyond grateful for you spending time with us and sharing your story. It is certainly a fantastic one, and love everything that you're doing now from a speaking perspective, your writing, helping so many folks. And, you know, if there's a picture you want to put by Damn Good Dog, I don't think yours would be a bad one to put by it. So we appreciate you. We're rooting for you, man.
I appreciate it, man. I got, and just let you know, I got something big that's coming. And so I'll probably have to come on here again, but it's definitely going to impact the college football world. It's going to empower a lot of former college athletes. And so, yeah, just letting you know, man, just be on the lookout.
Oh, we definitely will. And we'll absolutely have you back on to talk about that. So, yeah, that's exciting. We will be waiting anxiously to see what that's going to be all about.
Awesome, man. Yeah, I'm definitely going to need the support from the Bulldog Nation. So, for sure, I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Rennie. We really appreciate it.
So, dog.
All right, man. Go Dawgs.
Hey, George is better now.